Hey, whether you enjoy listening to Breaking Down Collapse or Building Up Resilience, I think you'll also really enjoy our bonus content on Patreon.
Yeah, Kellen and I take 20 minutes each week to talk about the news that's happening all around us and Collapse as it plays out. We like to have a little fun with it, but also make sure that you're aware of what's going on in the world of Collapse.
We look forward to having you join us there. The link to join us on Patreon is in the episode description.
All right. Hello, friends. Happy Wednesday. At least today is a Wednesday for me. It's probably not a Wednesday for you. Well, I guess there's a 1 in 7 chance. Thanks for being here. Been a couple crazy weeks. I took a vacation and was gone for a couple of weeks, so I apologize. It's been a little longer than normal for an episode. I spent some time on the Oregon coast with my family, and it's interesting, while we were there, we were in Cannon Beach, Oregon, and that's just south of Seaside. And the beach is wonderful. It's cold there compared to other beaches, and it was lovely to get out of the heat. Every time we go there, though, and we do go there somewhat often, every couple of years, I notice the tsunami evacuation zones. And I always, just the way my brain works, I've always sort of got a plan in the back of my head, right? If we're at the beach and the tsunami alarms go off, where do we go? Or if we're in bed at the hotel, what's the plan? And many people across the world this week got to experience just that, including those in Cannon Beach. I was just, a week and a half away from having experienced it myself. Because of the major earthquake that occurred in Russia, people all over the world, if you were on the coast, likely experienced some sort of tsunami watch, advisory, or warnings. Luckily, waking up this morning, found out that it was not, for most places, as bad as feared. I don't know if there was any loss of life where there were some larger waves in places like Japan or Russia. For now, it doesn't sound like it, but I know that there was a lot of sort of fear that in places like Hawaii, the west coast of the U.S., and Alaska, and then, of course, many of the Pacific islands and countries were concerned as well. Anyway, that said, it's another sort of proof that it's good to always have a plan in mind, hopefully, for these types of contingencies. Even though there was no major catastrophe, the evacuation itself and the panic that it can cause can become its own sort of catastrophe. If you're in Hawaii and you are traffic logged and sleeping in your car on high ground, you hopefully had a plan for that. Hopefully you had, I don't know if it needs to be a full bug out bag, but something in your car that you could just hop in and go. The grocery stores were full of people trying to get supplies because they knew they were going to be gone overnight, sleeping in their cars, and suddenly they were trying to get water bottles and whatever other supplies they felt they'd need. If you're one of the first ones ready, if your car's, you've got the bag in there with what you need, or a bag in your garage or by your front door or whatever that you can just walk out the door, take, and go, you're one of the first ones, right? And maybe you're not stuck in the traffic, and maybe you get the better high ground or the best location or whatever. I kind of reaffirmed that for me today that, yeah, even though there was no major tragedy from a tsunami, millions of people still got to experience what it is to either suffer because you were not prepared or to experience the relative comfort and, I don't know if peace is the right word, but knowing that you're as prepared as you could be and that, you got to put that into action and not experience as much inconvenience as others might have. All right. Well, that is an aside from the topic of today's episode, which is direct action. Not something we've talked about much on the podcast across our approaching 200 episodes. So Kellen and I, once upon a time, did do some episodes on different groups, and we talked about groups like Just Stop oil, Extinction Rebellion, and kind of the main focuses that those groups had and what they were trying to do to accomplish, you know, what they were trying to accomplish. But direct action is a much wider idea. And so we'll talk here a little bit about what direct action is. We'll talk about indirect action, what that is. Talk about the difference between violent and nonviolent direct action. I am not here to prescribe anything. I am not telling you to go be violent. I'm not telling you to go, you know, do direct action. This is more just to talk about, why do people do it? What is it? How can you get involved if that's something you're interested in? And I guess the big reason, or the big question, is why? Why does it become necessary? Why would someone go to sort of put out the energy or have the desire or need to engage in direct action? So I will say, kind of to start, that I am always fascinated by direct action. I live in a small town. I'm not in a place where there is much protesting, though recently with the No Kings protest, we did have something like 1,000 or so protesters, you know, at the local courthouse, which was pretty cool. I'm also in a fairly conservative area, and so seeing that, it just always inspires something in me. Back in 2020, during like the George Floyd protests, that was incredible to watch, right? Both the nonviolent protests, where there were just massive amounts of people, tens of thousands of people out in the streets every weekend or even every weekday protesting for a cause. On the more violent side of things, you had who are referred to as Antifa, even though that's not a formal group, but Antifa out on the streets. I guess it's more of an idea or an ideal. And many of, or much of that, grew to become more confrontational and more violent, whether that was violence against, you know, police who were there to stop the protests, or whether it was against private property. It's always been so interesting to me to watch and to see how those things escalate and who causes the escalation. Hint, it's usually the police, not usually the protesters, but that can happen as well. Anyway, that's just to point out my own sort of, I'm drawn to it. I just find it so fascinating. And, you know, I think if I was in a little bit of a different life, especially now where the country is headed, and right now with our current administration, what's happening to laws and what's happening to certain types of people being oppressed and what's happening with immigration and all of this stuff, I would be more likely to move somewhere where I can make a bigger impact. I would be more likely to, you know, put myself out there and maybe my career and want to do something. Last episode, I believe it was, or two episodes ago, I can't remember now, when I talked about Years and Years, the show from HBO, there is a moment at the end where she kind of calls her family to direct action indirectly. She basically calls them out, or calls herself out and everyone out, for saying, we asked for this life because we don't do anything about it. The things that we do is to bow to it. We continue to be, you know, we purchase the cheapest item because it's the best deal, even though it's not necessarily the right thing to do. Or we still get in our car and drive it around, and much of it is out of necessity. But she basically says, we haven't done a thing to stop it. And that is where direct action comes in. And yeah, that episode kind of just, it scratched that itch for me of being like, man, I wish that I was more engaged in direct action. All right. That said, why might a society feel the need to act? There are many, again, types of action that one can take. That can be indirect action, that can be direct action, that can be violent action. But why in the first place are we taking these actions? Well, there can be a number of reasons, right? Injustice in a system, corruption, oppression, whether you yourself are being oppressed or you're witnessing the oppression of others. When you notice that institutions are not responsive, so the courts, or whether it be politicians, the media is engaged in sort of or being complicit in the irresponsiveness of institutions to change according to the will of the people, and that the direction that it's headed is apparently or obviously negative. So when that happens, public trust can begin to collapse, right? The suffering of people increases, the powerlessness that people feel increases, and that can lead to this sort of unrest and desire to enact or create change. So people recognize, okay, the system is broken. What power do I have as an individual, or what power do we have as a group to make change? Can we fix the system? Can we turn it around? Do I have a part in it, right? And that is where we decide, okay, well, what type of action then do we take? So indirect action, that's action that you take within the system. That is the action that you take that has been put into law to say, when we want change, this is how we do it. We vote, right? Or we lobby, which, by the way, probably shouldn't be the law, but it is. We petition, we put forth lawsuits, right? Through the media and journalism, we try and create a movement towards change. And I think the biggest one of these that I've just mentioned is, of course, voting. That's the one that we really have the most, it's the most sort of quantitative change mechanism that we have. You go to the polls, you vote, you get the majority or whatever the requirement is, and that change happens, right? Well, what happens when that stops working, right? And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second, why a society might choose each type. That's when we get into more nonviolent direct action. So those are things like protests, sit-ins, boycotts, blockades. You can do online disruptions or symbolic disruptions. And these are used typically when those indirect methods either start to fail, they aren't viable anymore, or they're happening too slowly. If the rate of corruption, oppression, negative change is happening faster than your ability to change it indirectly through voting and lobbying and all that, then nonviolent direct action might become necessary. And from there, we move into violent direct action. This gets into more of the riots, the sabotage. You can see guerrilla warfare, and it can get as severe, right? It can escalate to a point of actual armed rebellion. And we have seen several examples of all three of these happening throughout history, both recent history and past history. Just some examples of past examples of direct action, some of them violent, some of them nonviolent, much of them and most of them a mix of both. But you have the civil rights movement in the U.S., the Montgomery bus boycott. That was Rosa Parks. It started with her arrest, right? And we have things like sit-ins in 1960. There was something called the Greensboro Four, where they sat in a Woolworth's lunch counter in North Carolina. And that, you know, they got in trouble for that, and that caused sit-ins all across the South. The Freedom Rides in 1961. So those are all part of the civil rights movement. We had things like labor movements, right? We had anti-apartheid movements in South Africa. There's been all sorts of environmental direct action, some of it more violent, some of it less, right? An example would just be in 2016, the Standing Rock pipeline that was going to be put in. I remember watching that pretty actively. Back then, we didn't have access to just watch like TikTok lives, and it wasn't all over Reddit. I guess it would have been on Reddit, but I remember watching it on some like obscure website, just trying to see live what was happening there in the protests. The AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, that was called ACT UP in the 80s and 90s. Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil. So just there's a whole list, and there have been, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of examples. We've got, of course, like the American Revolution, right? The French Revolution. These are examples of very epically violent uprisings. Some direct action attempts are more successful than others, right? Occupy Wall Street may have been successful in that it raised awareness, right? But it also didn't really change much as far as the wealth gap, right? It didn't really go anywhere in the end. It ended up getting broken apart by crackdowns. The encampments got, you know, disbanded, that type of thing. Same thing with Chaz and Chop in Seattle in 2020. That was during the Black Lives Matter protests. That got shut down pretty quick. Didn't really lead to lasting change. Weather Underground in the 1970s. Yellow Vests in France just a couple years ago. It started 2018. It's still going on today. The Tiananmen Square protests in China. In a way, these were all successful in their own right because they raised awareness, right? And they're still talked about today. But the actual immediate outcome was unsuccessful. Well, we'll dive in here and talk a little bit about what makes a type of action more successful based on the situation and circumstances. What can one do if you're pushed into one of these types of actions? How can you try and ensure it is most successful, right? And then also, which type typically tends to be more successful in the end? There's some research and books that have been written on this. And of course, I think there's going to be some serious subjectivity in there, but I do think it's worth mentioning. So first, let's kind of talk about when societies might choose each type of action. So indirect action is going to be chosen most often when legal routes remain viable, right? If I can go vote and know that, number one, my vote counts. Maybe I won't get what I want by voting. That's fine. But I have trust in the voting process, right? I trust that the votes are being counted correctly, that there's no sabotage or corruption happening there. How many places in the world can say that, right? If you live in Russia, does your vote count? Do you feel confident that if the majority votes a certain way, that that's what's going to happen, right? Or do you feel that way in Venezuela? Do you feel that way today in America, right? American voting has always had many flaws, in my opinion. I am not big on the Electoral College. Being in a mostly conservative state, I don't feel like my vote ever really matters, honestly, in either direction. My state's going to vote conservative. That's just the way that it is. So why bother, right? And that creates low voter turnout, low voter engagement. Maybe if in my state all of the liberal, if 100% of liberal voters went and voted, maybe that would change, right? On top of that, I don't consider myself a Democrat, right? I'm certainly not a member of the GOP. I am an independent. Do I feel like my voice is heard or considered when I go to vote? I can write in an independent, but I have basically two choices cherry-picked or hand-picked and put in front of me. And they say, here, you have a choice. Choose between these two. Well, you know, I don't want either of those two. So something like ranked choice voting or something like that, in my opinion, would be a much better situation. So I look at voting and I say, well, I mean, I can vote. I can vote for or against proposals, for or against laws that are being put, you know, put up for me to decide from. But my overall engagement in the process doesn't feel much like it counts. And on top of that, way back when, Kellen and I did an episode on lobbying. It was either in 2020 or 2021. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but it came out to like this idea that when voters vote for something, they only get 30% of what the majority votes for, where lobbyists get like 80% of what they want and what they pay for with their money. So even though the majority of people are voting for a thing, only 30% are they coming out with, of the time, are they coming out with their desired outcome. The rest of the time, the lobbyists get what they want because they have tons of money, which that is technically legal and therefore part of this whole indirect process, but that just drives the corruption part of it, right? And then nowadays we have some real issues with gerrymandering, right? With voter suppression. We have poll centers being shut down in certain locations. There's fear for, you know, immigrants to go to the polls because they're going to be questioned and arrested. And and all this intimidation and that type of stuff. Anyway, this is not me saying that, hey, indirect action is completely unviable and doesn't work anymore, but it is apparent in today's society, in the country and place where I live, that it's becoming less and less so every day. Maybe you feel that way about where you live, maybe you don't. And we see the results of this feeling bubbling over into now direct action. So when legal routes fail, but the public support for it is high, then it can spill over into nonviolent direct action. Taking to the streets, protesting for no kings, right? It starts to put some pressure on people, and it also helps build a movement. I know that I'm not alone in feeling like Donald Trump is a king, right? Or is acting like a king, that he's conserving power, that he's destroying the legal routes, the courts, right? And he is subverting them for his own desires. I know I'm not alone in that, because I see, hey, there's tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people on the street holding up their signs, talking about this, and it can be successful in creating change. It also very often is not. So violent direct action comes in when everything else fails. When people go out and protest and they are reacted to strongly by police or military, escalating, overreacting, arresting, once that repression becomes extreme and becomes violent in and of itself, when the state enacts violence on you for your nonviolent direct action, that's when it escalates and can create violent direct action. And oftentimes, it's going to move through all three of these stages, right? It starts with the people trying to vote, trying to make change peacefully, trying to go about it the way that's been laid out for them. Then it spills over into them taking direct action into the streets and saying, enough is enough. We're striking. We are boycotting. We are protesting. And then from there, often it then evolves into more violence. And again, just to reiterate, violence can be started from either side, right? Protests can turn to riots because a group of protesters decide to set a building on fire or throw rocks or, you know, carry weapons or whatever that might be. But it is more often initiated by the police. You often see a peaceful protest, even though it may be considered an illegal gathering, right? Maybe they're on the street and they didn't have a permit to be on the street. And so the police react and they say, great, pull out the tear gas, pull out the non-lethal weapons, and fire those non-lethal weapons in a way that they become potentially lethal, right? The violence starts there. And people, of course, react. There will always be a certain subset of people that will see the violence begin and they will say, it's time to go home. I am a nonviolent protester. I'm not engaging in this. But you have the people who remain, who stand up for the others, right? And who are willing to stand up to a system that's oppressing them at their own personal peril. It can result in bodily injury. It can result in death. It can result in being arrested. And that being arrested can result in being fired from your job, right? Or affecting a relationship or your family or whatever that is. It's no small thing to take part in violent direct action. So what type is more successful? And I find this really interesting, and I think that there's more to look into here. This part could probably be an entire episode. But there is one book which is called Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. This book is obviously all about why nonviolent conflict, in their opinion, is better. And I say in their opinion, there is also empirical evidence based on, you know, looking back on 323 major resistance campaigns from 1900 to 2006. So they gathered their evidence, they provided their theory here, which is nonviolent movements were twice as likely to succeed as violent ones. The success rates for nonviolent were 53%, and the success rate for violence was around 26%. This is by someone named Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan. Now, there may be a lot of reasons why. Here are some that they list. Here's why they list that nonviolent action often works better. So there's a low barrier to participation in nonviolence, right? You can go to a protest and have 10,000 people show up. Those 10,000 people might include, you know, the 85-year-old grandma and the 8-year-old child. They are not likely, those two groups of people are probably not willing to engage in violence. And so as far as a widespread participation, optics and things like that, that nonviolent action just has the chance to be bigger. There's the potential for more legitimacy from a moral superiority standpoint, right? I'm not one to say whether or not moral superiority is what one should go for in a situation, and it's going to depend on the situation. But, you know, when someone starts throwing rocks or setting a building on fire or tagging it with graffiti, that can start to become a thing that people will look at negatively, even people that might agree with you. They may say, okay, now this has gone too far. I don't agree with the movement because it's defacing the building or because it's causing property damage, those types of things. In that regard, it is harder for a state or a regime or a government or a police force to justify like a harsh crackdown or oppression of a protest when there is nonviolence. Now, that's not to say that they don't, because they most certainly do. Many a peaceful protest turns violent or is ended because the police crack down and say enough is enough. But it becomes harder to justify if the people protesting are engaging 100% peacefully. It's when the justification that the police use and they say, oh, a rock was thrown or a water bottle was thrown or that graffiti is, you know, that building's being tagged or whatever the case is. That's what they use to justify the harsh crackdowns, and that can end a movement. Typically, nonviolent action has the ability to be more sustainable in a long term, so that pressure can stick around for longer. For example, a boycott that over time has, you know, negative effects on an economy or on a specific corporation or something like that, or on taxes, that can build pressure over a longer time, whereas a violent action can disrupt that, right? It can be more short-lived. Because violence escalates, typically there's a point at which there has to be a de-escalation, and that typically happens quicker. And then lastly, when a violent action or a campaign of violent action ends, and if it ends, whether you want to deem it successful or not, but it can often end in kind of a collapse of authority, creating a vacuum, right? So like Syria, as an example, they might have achieved their purpose of toppling an authoritative regime, but in exchange, they got a power vacuum, which was filled by other authoritative regimes, right? Or by groups vying for power, which created more violence. So as far as post-conflict outcomes go, peacefully causing change through nonviolent pressure is often can be considered a more successful termination of the conflict. Okay, so that was according to their book, Why Does It Typically Better for Nonviolent? And now here's where they talk about why it's typically worse for violent movements. And it's basically the opposite of what I just said, but it's still worth mentioning. You're going to have narrow participation. So people, like I said, the 8-year-old and the 80-year-old aren't going to go out and fight, right? And even in many cases, the 20-year-old or the 30-year-old, they don't want to engage in violence because they either don't want to risk what that means for them and their family, or they're just not willing to participate in that. So you might have a small subgroup of people willing to go that direction. In many cases, the state is going to have superiority when it comes to military or to police. No matter how you look at it, like protesters out on the street are going to always be outgunned by the authorities. Doesn't mean that they can't create a sustainable, you know, campaign. Yes, you get guerrilla warfare, but the ability to produce violence is monopolized by the state. You also, again, get that idea of like public backlash. People have, you know, this idea of moral high ground or moral superiority, and they don't want to watch their cities burn down. And so you might lose support for your campaign through the violence. We see, you know, all the backlash that comes from or goes to Just Stop Oil or Extinction Rebellion by people who might agree with their cause, but say, I hate it that you block traffic. I'm trying to get to work. I agree with you. I don't think we should be consuming as much as we are, but like, I still got to feed my family. So get off the road, right? That is escalated, especially when we're talking about violence. Again, it can justify or legitimize repression. So it can make it so that a state or a police force can say, oh, they set the building on fire. I'm going to release the tear gas. That crackdown happens, martial law, whatever it ends up being, gives them sort of this feeling of authority and justification to enact strict and oppressive actions. Okay. That said, in the previous section, we kind of talked about why someone goes from a indirect to direct to violent direct action. Sometimes you may not have a choice, right? Maybe the success rate of a violent direct action campaign is less than the success rate of the nonviolent, but maybe your nonviolent was already unsuccessful. And if you've gone from a point where nonviolence is not going to make a change, then societies move towards violent direct action because it's all that's left. Yeah, I might have a low chance of success here, but the oppression and the corruption and all of that is such that if I don't take action, my life will be more miserable, and it is worth doing whatever it requires to try to improve the situation. So some ways, times when violence can succeed or when it has succeeded in the past is when those nonviolent channels are shut down, right? If a dictatorship says you are no longer allowed to protest in the streets, right? As is seen in Russia, for example. Okay, well, now we know nonviolence is not an option. When violence is targeted, and not indiscriminate. So if we are working on, for example, somebody is sabotaging infrastructure rather than something that could harm civilians. So a terrorist attack, right, is not going to be a successful, or is not as likely to be a successful piece of direct action. Whereas targeting a specific piece of infrastructure, a building or something like that, can be. Mentions being part of a broader strategy, not having violence as the only tactic, and it will have more success the more broad social support it has. The more people that are feeling that same feeling of being so oppressed that something has to be done. So in huge liberation movements, some examples would be in Haiti in the past, or Algeria or Syria, that broad social support can make for a more successful revolution. You know, you think of like the French Revolution, and it takes more than just the people in the streets fighting. There has to be a whole supply line of, you know, people willing to house those who are engaging in the activities, people who are willing to supply them, to feed them. If you have that type of broad social support, you're more likely to have success. All right. Lastly, sort of in regards to the three different types of actions that we've talked about here, what makes each one the most successful, right? Just to give some ideas, if you are engaged in indirect action, you want to stay completely within the law and the prescribed methods for making change, what is going to make that the most successful? So organization is huge. If we're talking about indirect action, having a clear message, a clear campaign, and a way to get that message out there to a wide audience is going to be the most effective way to start. Of course, you as an individual putting forth, you know, expressing your rights and your opinions and being able to go to the voting booth is extremely important. But driving that message en masse to others is the most important. And that's why we see like social media has totally changed the voting landscape. Whether it's through positive ways, like these types of campaigns and their ability to spread, or in negative ways through misinformation and disinformation and how quickly that information can spread. It's one of the biggest concerns of our times right now, right? That you can put out a piece of misinformation, which is getting more and more convincing every day due to AI, that can spread like wildfire. And then correct information can go out and it can barely find any movement. But that is, again, how to find the most success is having an organized voter base who is spreading the message, building coalitions. So you're not acting in individual silos, but you're working together to build coalitions for a certain cause, focusing on incremental and local wins. Voting really has the most effect on a local scale on the ability to change what's happening in your community, because a series of communities changing is what will then change things at the county or the state level, which of course then builds up to the national level. When it comes to nonviolent direct actions, many fail because they don't have clear and specific goals and demands, right? You might see a group get together for a protest and you know they're protesting something, or they know they're protesting something, but there's not a list, right? There's not a specific goal. If we go out and we protest No Kings, which I think is good to spread awareness, but what specifically are we asking to change? Are we saying, here's a list of things that we require, which is that power goes back to the Supreme Court or to the lower courts, and they continue to have the ability to stop the president from taking certain actions? We demand that, you know, the president does not have immunity under any official act he takes in office. We demand XXYZ and continue persistently to demand those things and to grow the number of people demanding those things. That's where more change is possible. Nonviolence is most successful when people are trained in being disciplined and in strategy. If you're trying to keep it nonviolent to ensure that people are not going out and causing issues, you know, during the No Kings protests, there was only a very small number of deaths directly from those protests. And I can actually, I'm thinking that there was at least two that were heard of, but one in particular was in Salt Lake City in Utah, where a protester was shot. And it turned out to be a big miscommunication that there was supposed to be like people volunteered to be protest security, and they were there to kind of help keep the peace, but they were carrying weapons. And one of them thought that another guy who was carrying a weapon was going to shoot up the crowd. And so he shot him. Turns out they were both on the same side. They were both there protesting, and the man who was shot was killed, right? So it's a lack of discipline, a lack of strategy, and that can cause escalations, it can cause rumors, misinformation, and it can break apart a coalition. Two last points here, using diverse tactics in nonviolent action. So not just going and doing a protest, right? But creating a boycott campaign and specific strikes and the media campaigns or economic disruption, all around the same demands, but showing that you have the power of people behind you and they're exerting their power in ways that are actually affecting, you know, the government or affecting other voters. That's how these things grow. Lastly, staying nonviolent under provocation. I know that's controversial. If you are trying to remain nonviolent, some of the most successful campaigns in history have been people remaining nonviolent while the state oppresses them. It's not good optics for the state to oppress a people who are just letting it happen, who are peaceful, have been peaceful through and through, and in that peace are being arrested, killed, injured, whatever it might be. Those are extremely powerful optics for a campaign. That said, do you want to be a victim of that, right? Like, you are putting yourself in danger by not fighting back and allowing yourself to be injured, arrested, whatever it may be. But it does kind of preserve, again, that view of having a moral high ground. All right, moving lastly on to violent direct action. If it's going to be used, what makes it most successful? Being highly strategic, again, and targeted. So we're not trying to be random. We're not trying to be indiscriminate. If someone is engaging in a violent direct action, they are doing so in a way that furthers that list of demands and goals. It takes into their own hands the carrying out of that goal, right? It's not going to do us any good if I have a goal of ending environmental disruption and I end up inconveniencing or hurting a group of people who have nothing to do with it. Earlier, we had talked about how you kind of get this small group of people willing to show up and fight in a violent direct action. And you need to have, again, more support. There needs to be mass support, even if not all the people in that group are being violent. They need to be able to have the emotional and morale support, as well as tangible support through things, again, like supplies, meals, housing, that type of thing. It has to be paired with vision for a political future and the ability to show that vision to people so it doesn't look like we're just fighting to fight. And we have a clear cause in addition to our list of demands and a sort of desired or established outcome. We want to build a long-term institution, right? The violence needs to have an end in mind of peace and a pathway to achieve that. And with that, you have to be able to accept that there's a high risk of backlash, of loss of legitimacy, and again, of failure, which can cause a sort of a vacuum or further disruptions that may make life even harder. Okay. And again, I just want to make it clear that I am not advocating for violent action. I'm not advocating for any type of action, mostly just to explain again, the different types, when they have been successful in the past, how they can be successful in the future, and why one might choose or not to choose a certain type of action. Okay. Lastly, to end the episode, what if none of it works, right? Or what if you decide that you don't want to participate in it? Maybe you are in a country in which there is massive oppression, in which there is corruption and your vote doesn't count or you can't vote or whatever the case may be. And you say, we've tried the indirect action. We've tried nonviolent. We've even tried violent. We are simply just oppressed and there is nothing that it seems we can do about it. Or maybe people are engaged in active violence or nonviolence in an attempt to change, but you don't want to participate in that. Maybe you want to do your best to survive in the situation in which you're in. So essentially the question is, what do we do when nothing works, but we find ourselves in a system that does continue to oppress us? What options do we have? And this is really where, on a personal level or on a community level, you have to shift from resistance to resilience. And this is, this goes into the brief stint in which we had with building up resilience and the community building aspect to that. This is mutual aid, right? Solidarity networks. It's providing for each other. It can turn into things like underground education, bypassing propaganda, making sure that people are kept, in the right paradigm, in the right perspective. You can even go so far as to create shadow economies, right? You can resist the economic control of a corrupt state through bartering, right? Through cash, through co-ops, through basically creating and managing your local economy, not regulated by those who control it. And then, of course, along with that, alternative institutions. So you can have, whether it's education through schools, security that reflects your local community values or neighborhood values, courts. It takes, this isn't just a simple, flip the switch and we do this, but it's the slow building of community, essentially community government that goes outside of the regular lawful community directives or government directives, I should say. So some examples of this, this sort of constructive resistance. It's not just about fighting the power actively, but finding ways to replace it in daily life. So the Polish Solidarity Movement, they ran underground schools, underground publications and journalism before it eventually gained legal recognition. But during the time where it was illegal, right, people were supporting each other. People were educating their kids, not in the indoctrinated ways in which the government might be attempting to do so. Another example is there were regions, Kurdish regions in Rojava, in which these were stateless regions, but they built alternative governance and councils, gender equality councils, despite all this opposition from different regimes, multiple regimes. They were kind of able to insulate themselves and create sort of a community-based solution under the radar of government. Again, I know this is not like, that's so much easier said than done, but that's why it's so important now to build trust and just build community, get to know the people around you, so that if the moment comes or when the moment comes where something like this is necessary, you have the building blocks, you have the network of people. It's just now about actually putting it together and finding ways to communicate and create these things together. You can do things like either forming or joining insular movements. So it kind of allows you to withdraw either partially or fully from your normal societal expectations. Things like intentional communities, right? This is something that's talked a lot about in regards to collapse, off-grid settlements, communes, things like that. There's a lot of difficulty with running those. You hear all the time about drama within them, and many of them fail. But in a situation where you live in a place where it kind of comes down to the only solution or the way to survive outside of an oppressive government, it's good to know that people are out there practicing this. They're putting this into play. They're proving the theory or disproving the parts that don't work. But yeah, I've never been part of an intentional community, but I think that, again, given a different life situation, it may be something that I attempt in an effort to know if it was ever necessary within my country or my state to try this. I could have learned what to do and what not to do. There are cultural preservation groups. I've seen some of this locally here, and you hear about these groups all over. Indigenous crops, you know, that's something that I saw recently popping up here, where someone, they form a group, and it's not just for indigenous people, but you can go and you can learn and join and be a part of an indigenous garden, and they teach you the ways that things used to be done. And it's a good way also to be able to resist sort of the oppression and assimilation of cultural groups. Underground religious or spiritual networks. Spirituality, you may think that's important, you may not, but I think in an oppressive government situation, it is a great way to be able to either find peace. You may consider it coping or escapism, but we've all got to do it. We've all got to cope or escape. So that's another option. And you can also find great support through that as well. But the main goal here, right, is we're trying to preserve our identity. We're trying to insulate ourselves until a more favorable moment emerges, right? Maybe we're not part of the fighting, but maybe that fighting will lead to something. Maybe we're not part of the indirect action, but maybe that will eventually result in something. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a second. One thing before that is you can leverage international or outside pressure. Does this always work? You know, depending on the situation, it may or may not work. We see right now countries all over the world that are engaged in internal conflict, humanitarian crises, and there may or may not be aid coming in from the outside, right? We see right now with Israel and Gaza this insanely horrific humanitarian crisis unfolding. And who is there to help, right? Well, partially Israel won't let people in. There's blockades. There's them deciding who gets to bring aid and who doesn't, and what aid gets in and doesn't. And even when aid is brought in, you know, they're shooting people as they're getting aid, all this type of thing. So trying to leverage international pressure isn't always going to work. But it is one of those things that there can be sort of attempts at from a little bit of an underground, if you're not willing to fight back, right, you can appeal for help by building alliances, you know, getting your word out there through social media. There's always risks to that, of course. You may be putting your face or your name out on the internet if that was, you know, there's a danger to that as well. And it kind of starts to blend into action that you're taking, nonviolent action. But for places in the world, for example, where maybe their internet is restricted, you know, North Korea, China, where there's certain things that they are not supposed to be able to see, but being able to use digital tools to bypass that censorship, right? And either see what's happening outside or show the world what's happening outside. There is a lot of power in, you know, being able to see inside of Iran when normally they're trying to keep stuff from coming out, but you can see the oppression and see what's happening at protests. That can drive international pressure. And that pressure, whether it's from governments or whether, you know, it's people rising up and protesting, we see international protests happening all the time in support of other countries. And so that sort of pressure on your own government can then push them to sanction or take action or whatever needed on the government of people that are being oppressed. Okay, sorry if that was a little convoluted, but and then lastly, and this is where we'll end, is waiting for that regime to change, to weaken, or to collapse. We know things are headed that direction, right? If we can build these sort of insular communities as things get worse, then we are able to bide our time, right, before taking any sort of action when the time might be right. Right now, direct action may not function, right? It may not change things, right? Maybe it still could, maybe it is. But if things got to a point where state oppression was so strong that there was just no option for any sort of action to make change, then the option may just be to wait and bide the time for when that government implodes, collapses, is weak. There's economic breakdown, right? There's fragmentation in a party or amongst elites. There's disillusionment widespread amongst people. International support disappears. There's military defection. There's all these different things that can happen that can signal to you, okay, now is when people should rise up. And in the meantime, we've been, you know, creating our communities, insulating ourselves the best that we can. And for many of us, I think what it kind of all comes down to, I think many people living in society today have sort of already done this, and that is simply disengaging and surviving, right? I get into this mode sometimes. I know I'm still very, extremely lucky, right? I am privileged to live where I do and how I do. There are so many people who are in so much worse of a situation than I am. And yet I feel like in my own situation, sometimes like this system that I hate, this system that I feel is not good for society, it's not good for our mental health, it's not good for the world, I have to kind of disengage from that, right? Other people in other parts of the world, or even in this part of the world in different situations, have to literally survive, right? I don't have to worry about my immediate physical well-being and survival, right? I'm doing fine. I have access to food and water and shelter and all of that. Other people do not, right? There are people who are physically trying to survive in the world and disengage from the effects of collapse around them. But I guess that's just to say there's different levels of where we're at, right? You might find yourself in a system that you hate and you might feel this need to disengage in order to protect your mental health. We're trying to minimize cooperation in the system, right? We're protecting our cultural identity. We're protecting our mental health. We're trying to preserve historical memory or documents or photos or whatever it might be for future generations. We're trying to make sure that what we care about, that what should persist, does, while at the same time trying our hardest to remove ourselves from the system or from the situation, the oppression and the results of that are happening. So, sort of as a final thought, if oppression is deeply entrenched in your system. And direct action, indirect action is failing. It doesn't always have to be that the next step is more confrontation, right? Especially for coming from a resilience standpoint, system building, underground resilience, patience, timing, like those kind of become the keys. Protect yourself, build community with others who have the same vision and same feelings as you do. And the timing may come when you are able to take action that can make a real change. In the long term, we know, because we're listening to this podcast, we most likely understand and believe that the world is headed towards ultimate collapse. My opinion is that collapse is not the end of humanity, right? It's the end of our system, which in a way is a positive thing, right? It will come with suffering. It will come with hardships. It's going to come with a lot of devastation and destruction and all of that. But if our goal is to make change, is to live within the system that we want to see, then a destruction of the current one can kind of be viewed in that positive light. What does come after, and what ability do we as people have to help decide what that future looks like? That's not me being delusional and saying that I expect myself to be part of that or to, you know, be around when collapse does take place. But how can I, you know, build a world in which my children are brought up with a proper education, right? And my children are the most insulated from the system possible. How can I build a world in which I give myself or my community the best chance at being the one that makes it through or being amongst the ones that make it through? There's so little known about what's going to happen in the next 10, 20, 30, 50, 80, 100 years, other than the overall trajectory. All I know is that some people will attempt the types of action that we talked about today. Some people will attempt to remove and disengage themselves, be more based on survival. I'm not prescribing one method or the other. Each person has to do what they feel is right for them in their given situations. And like most things, the most correct answer is probably that it is a mixture of all of the above. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. Hopefully you found some value in this topic. If you feel like I got anything super wrong, if your opinion differs from mine strongly, I always welcome hearing it. You can find me at collapsepod@gmail.com. User Corey John on Reddit. Feel free to reach out. As always, join us on Patreon. That's another great place to communicate with me. We've got a Discord channel there. You can contact me on Patreon itself, and I'll try to respond. Thanks so much. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.